From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Carina, Carina, get where you've been so long. Carina, Carina, get where you've been so long. I've been worried about you, baby. Baby, please come home.
Bob Dylan, 1962. Not his own song yet, but his own sound. He would soon conquer the world, and Victor Mamoudis was already at his side in the coffeehouse world of Greenwich Village. He would be way inside Dylan's world for almost 40 years. Now he's telling that story with help from his son Jake, stories of the most unknowable artist. This hour on Point, an insider's telling of the Bob Dylan story. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's your question still about Bob Dylan? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. In a moment, we will hear from Jake Mamoudis, the son of the late Victor Mamoudis, tour manager and friend of Bob Dylan. From the early 60s and for almost 40 years, Victor Mamoudis was tour manager, confidant, body man, chess partner to Bob Dylan. Before he died in 2001, he made many hours of tapes about that time with Dylan. His son Jake has brought those stories out in a new book, Another Side of Bob Dylan. Jake Mamoudis joins us in just a minute. But first, with me in the studio is Tim Riley, music critic, author, rock culture maven, professor of journalism at Emerson College, author of, among others, Hard Rain, a Dylan commentary. Tim Riley, welcome back to On Point.
Nice to be here, Tom.
Why do we never tire of trying to suss out what's behind the front of Bob Dylan?
Well, we have so much to talk about when we talk about Bob Dylan. Of course, he's one of our most important songwriters of our era. You know, he's the next great American rock and roll figure after Elvis Presley. And, you know, the cliche is that you can't understand the 60s unless you understand people like Bob Dylan and their work. Another question is, how come that work remains with us? How come it remains so relevant? Why are students at college so interested in learning about Bob Dylan? And what is it about that material that speaks through time, that steps around his era and actually speaks to the young people of today?
Jake Mamoudis' father, Victor, had a perspective almost like no other on this artist. You've read the book, Another Side of Bob Dylan. Of course, that was famously the name of one of his early albums. What jumped out at you from this telling, from the inside of that Dylan bubble?
Well, this is really pulling back the curtain and showing what backstage looked like with Bob Dylan, what it was like to hang around with him backstage, what it was like to watch him writing. There's a lot of interesting details there about his writing habits. One of my favorite stories is how they're off on vacation, and Victor, his personal assistant, is out swimming and just vacating, and Dylan is holed up in a hotel room writing the whole time. And they get back to New York, and Dylan spends one whole day laying down this album, Another Side of Bob Dylan, and Victor is completely gobsmacked because he has no idea that Dylan has been writing a complete album and rehearsing all these songs alone with himself, has never performed these songs for anybody. So now we know, at least according to Victor, that this album is actually the debut of these Dylan songs from Dylan to the microphone to the world.
He never just burst out of him with no idea. I mean, yes. Such song, All I Really Want to Do, Spanish Harlem Incident, Chimes of Freedom, I Shout, but My Back Pages, It Ain't Me, Babe. Boom, out they come. It's incredible.
And the album has always had that kind of feel to it of this great rushing out, this great outpouring. It's like a dam bursting of all of these ideas and all of these colors. And of course, Chimes of Freedom is on that record. There's some real interesting stuff going on that record. I think I've always thought of it as a great breakthrough record when he's between his folk idiom and the rock idiom. And it's almost like he's stepping into the rock idiom without electric guitars.
Yeah,
there's a
yeah.
great electric psychedelic feel to that record, even though it's all acoustic.
Let's go to the man who, channeling his father, using his father's many hours of tape, has brought us this story, and we're grateful for it. Jacob Mamoudis joins us from Culver City, California. Writer, son of the late Victor Mamoudis, tour manager, friend, and more to Bob Dylan, editor and co-author with his deceased father of Another Side of Bob Dylan, a personal history on the road and off the tracks. Jacob Mamoudis in California, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
This is really an incredible thing. There's an incredible family story here as well. Bob Dylan, in many ways, shaped the life of your father and your family. These tapes almost miraculously survived a house burning down. Your mom's in New Mexico. But you have brought them to life. How many hours of tape were there, Jacob?
Oh, there's quite a few. There's over 24. But really what I used was the main bulk, which is 12. There's a 13th tape, which I couldn't bring myself to listen to. But for this conversation, 24 hours that I used to shape this story.
Couldn't bring yourself because this is emotional for you. This was right out of the heart of your family's life.
It was very cathartic. It was very emotional. The 13th tape is actually in the hand recorder that he used to record. And I was afraid to listen to it, afraid of what I was going to hear, since he died from an aneurysm. And I talked to him on the phone while he was having this.
You know, I wonder if you would be good enough to take us right back to the beginning so we can begin to learn about your father and Bob Dylan through some of his own words, his own voice. You've got a description early on in the book, Another Side of Bob Dylan, where your dad heads down into the Gaslight Cafe, McDougal Street in Greenwich Village, and there is, well, maybe you could read for us, Jacob.
Absolutely. This is an excerpt from page 39.
What year would this be, 1960?
This is 1961.
Okay, take us back.
We walk downstairs, and it's this dark place. Wood tables and chairs in the center, and booths on the sides. Only amber color lighting, candles lighting the room, and it's much darker than would be legal. Dave Von Gronk is on stage singing, "Cocaine, Cocaine," all around my weary brain. I instantly felt like it was this fantastic spot. There's a stage at the end of the room, with the kitchen sitting behind it. Dressing rooms are upstairs. I noticed Bill Cosby walking around. He wasn't performing that particular night, but he was a regular figure in the village. And there was Bob. He was sitting at a table on the right side with a couple of guys. He wore big clunky boots, a corduroy seaman's cap, and a fall weather jacket. He was twirling a cigarette in one hand and clasping a cup of coffee in the other. There was no bar, so everyone was just drinking coffee. He and I got introduced, and we didn't say much right away. Ramblin' Jack shot off a list of my accomplishments, while I just nodded and tried to be unassuming. We smoked some cigarettes together, and I rolled a joint that we smoked with the group. Bob was just sitting and writing in a little spiral notebook. His penmanship was unreadable, which I believe he never improved upon on purpose, so it'd be harder to decipher. Looking very preppy in a collar and tie under his Temple University sweater, Bill Cosby came up to us while we were lighting up again. He started telling us that we shouldn't smoke pot. "You can't do this," he said as he shook his head with that very same voice and long face that would warn Fat Albert and raise the Huxtable kids, as well as an entire generation of television viewers. "You'll waste your lives. You'll grow hair on your hands and lose your sex drive. You'll grow breasts," he said. We had a good laugh about it and just kept on smoking.
Jacob Mahmouda is reading there what from his father's tapes about a long ago life with Bob Dylan. What a great reading voice you have, Jake. Jacob, it's almost a Kerouac-ish there. Really helps us go back. Who would have pictured, of all things, Bill Cosby wandering around in Bob Dylan territory?
Don't do it.
Apparently, he's quite the figure then.
Yeah, and Bob Dylan sitting there performing. You describe how he would do that after hours and writing in the Gaslight Cafe.
Yes. It was quite a time. I wish I was there. I wish I could have seen it. It was great hearing it from my father, though. He really loved that era.
Among the songs coming out of Bob Dylan at that time, "A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall."
I heard the sound of a thunder that roared out a warning. I heard the roar of a wave that could drown the whole world. I heard 100 drummers whose hands were a-blazing. I heard 10,000 whispering and nobody listening. I heard one person starve, I heard many people laughing. I heard the song of a poet who died in the gutter. I heard the sound of a clown who cried in the alley. And it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard rain curtains are gonna fall.
And Victor Mamoudis was there. Jikki Mamoudis, did your dad know early on that he was on to in the presence of something special with Bob Dylan?
You know, from the first time he heard him, he knew that there was something special, but he didn't know the gravity of what it was. It took him a while to really figure that out. But, I mean, not too long, a couple of months.
And within that time, they started having big conversations. Before you knew it, they'd be really close. Your dad would be in the middle of Dylan's touring. They would drive across the country in a little Ford station wagon with Dylan banging out songs on a typewriter in the back seat. Jikki Mamoudis, please stand by in Culver City, California. With his father's tapes, he's out with a new book, Another Side of Bob Dylan, A Personal History, on the road and off the tracks. So much great Dylan. Here's Masters of War from 1962, 1964, protest against Cold War arms, recorded at the Whitmark, here on the Whitmark demos of the early 60s. You can join us this hour. Tim Riley's with us as well. What's your question on the backstage, offstage, back pages of Bob Dylan from his youth, those early days in Greenwich Village, from the heart of his career? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
And I hope that you die, and your death will come soon. I'll follow your casket by the pale afternoon, and I'll watch while you lord down to your deathbed. And I'll stand over your grave till I'm sure that you're dead. I ain't looking to compete with you, beat or cheat or mistreat you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a new insider's story on the rise and times of Bob Dylan, from tapes of a man who spent nearly 40 years with him, written up for us by his son, Jikki Mamoudis, who joins us from Culver City, California. Took his father Victor's tapes 24 hours or more, and out of them brought a family story, his own family, which is very affecting, and the story of an American legend who his father was so close to. It's called Another Side of Bob Dylan, A Personal History, on the road and off the tracks. Critic, rock culture maven Tim Riley joins us as well. He's written about John Lennon and rock and roll and gender in America. And he wrote Hard Rain, a Dylan commentary, joins us today. You can join us. Is Bob Dylan a mystery man to you? Do you want to keep him that way? Do you want to hear these tales? Driving cross-country, on the road with Dylan, rolling joints with the Beatles. 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Jikki, what was your dad's background that put him in Bob Dylan's world?
My father just loved music. He was so intrigued by it. And he himself was a guitar player, at least until he met Bob. But up until that point, up until 1961, he was promoting concerts. He ran a coffee shop that had a stage. He was very in tune with that sort of generation and how that counterculture movement was building in Los Angeles.
Then he was in New York, and there was Dylan in from Minnesota. Dylan would still go back to Minnesota in those days, sometimes once at least for the winter you described. But when he was in New York, you've got another section there I wish you'd read. This is so early in Dylan's career, he wasn't performing like everyone else. He would wait until the Gaslight closed down and then perform just for the staff. Could you read that for us, Jake?
Absolutely. This is from page 40. Bob wasn't performing like everyone else was at this time. He would wait till closing, then ask if he could do a song or two, which is what he did this night as well. He sat on the stool and sang Carina Carina, House of the Rising Sun, and Buffalo Skinners. None of his own, just those three. He did, however, do his own take on Carina Carina, a bluesier version that contains the original lyrics. But his melody was closer to what Robert Johnson was doing. As he started playing the song, the cafe staff were working, cleaning up the place. But one by one they stopped, and their work came to a halt as they all fell under Bob's magic. 12 people stood and listened until he was done, and then applauded. His intensity and simplicity was fabulous, and his use of the harmonica was an instant hit for me. It should be said that at this moment, I had zero inclination that in the future he was going to write songs, incredible songs, songs that would move people.
That would move mountains,
Jacob. I did mess that up a little bit.
That's
sorry
all right.
About that.
You've got little, it here. I just bring it in because indeed they did. They moved nations. They moved the world in many ways, got the whole world listening. That from the very, very earliest days of Bob Dylan in New York, Jacob Bermudez reading there from a transcript of his father's tapes of that time. Foster in Branfells, Texas is calling. Foster, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. Yeah, my question was, did you have any idea of how Bob personally felt about his harmonica playing? I know as a singer-songwriter, it's a nice tool for just a one-act concept, but I didn't know if he ever had any comments on his level of harmonica playing.
Jacob, did your father speak to that?
You know, he didn't mention it specifically how Bob felt about himself. But my father appreciated it. He loved it, and he thought that Dylan was actually quite spectacular at it. There were other musicians in the village at that time that that helped Bob sort of foster his talent with that. And I wrote about that a little bit in my book. But it's hard to say exactly how Bob felt personally regarding his own harmonica playing.
Tim Riley, it's striking to me, was striking in the book. I mean, you associate harmonica with Dylan, and yet here, so early in the Gaslight Cafe, there he is with just a dozen or so staffers, and he's still not just strumming his guitar, the harmonica already central to his presentation.
Right, so here we get a picture of the early embryonic Bob Dylan building this persona, and the harmonica is a key piece of that, especially with our idea of the early Dylan persona. I've always thought of Dylan's harmonica playing as sort of this wayward lead guitar player that he has along from early on, so that when he's done singing and playing, then this harmonica comes in, and his harmonica is, you know, it's so distinctive. You're not going to mistake Bob Dylan's harmonica playing for anybody else's harmonica playing. And just like his voice, people will complain about it and saying, wow, he can't even play that thing. And really, the test is, how often can you listen to it and still be surprised by it? And his harmonica is a constantly surprising element in all of his performances.
He was surprising in many ways, even to those who spent so much time with him. Your father writes how, as much time as he spent with Dylan, even to him there was something that wasn't open. And for a friend, he writes at one point, empathy was not something that in personal relationships Bob Dylan was big on.
Yeah, it's true, yeah. They had a very intriguing relationship, one that I got to see firsthand. And he had a lot to say about it, but, you know, throughout the years, they always got along. My father created a lot of space for Bob to be himself.
Let's go to Tug in Melrose, Massachusetts. Tug, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great, great show today. Great topic. When I heard Karina, I thought, God, what a wonderful guy that is.
Yeah.
I've been listening to him for decades. Here's a question. From the Scorsese film and from other things, there emerges a side of Bob Dylan which is actually very unattractive. I mean, here was a guy whose art was like a force of nature, and he was very, very confident in it. He ended up, remember, stealing records, effectively, hard-to-find records from a friend or colleague in Minnesota because he felt he needed to listen to them. There's something almost amoral about his art form. And, in fact, the way that he can switch ideologies, going from saying in the Scorsese film, well, I'm not a politically active guy, and then doing all of those songs from the civil rights era and the anti-war movement, and then becoming a devout Christian, that beautiful song Dark Eyes from that period. I just would like to hear what your guests might think of that.
The amoral Bob Dylan, the shape-shifting Bob Dylan. What do you learn from your father's tapes, Jacob, from your own observation?
Well, I mean, it takes a lot to sort of find that creativity. And, you know, it's I would say that they both got up to a lot of shenanigans. And, you know, if Bob sort of did those things, I guess, you know, well, my father definitely wasn't going to stand in the way. He was there to foster his talent. So it was kind of a do whatever it took. My father really saw that, and Bob saw what he was capable of, you know, so... it makes sense to me, but, you know.
Jacob's father is very generous. He says even without empathy from this friend, it was worth it to him to have the front row seat on genius, Tim.
Well, here's a person who's particularly sensitive to the artistic sensibility at play here, and who has a front row seat on the development, quite literally the development of a major artist who's busy exploring and deepening his creativity with every new record. And I think this lack of empathy phrase is really just a very kind of smooth brush over, someone who's basically a jerk, who's really just very self-interested and very narcissistic. Us critics tend to look at this issue and say, yeah, we really just want to trust the art and not the artist, you know. Reading this book, it made me feel I'm so lucky that I got to know Dylan on an artistic level and that I was around while he was producing so I could participate as an audience member. I'm so glad I didn't have to babysit this guy.
I mean, the driven quality of Dylan and the way it put him apart from people, even when he was right next to them, is just amazing in this telling, Jacob. Your dad and Dylan driving across country, we'll talk about some of that. Then not long after in Greece, your dad sort of hanging out, enjoying the Aegean Sea, Dylan drinking coffee and smoking and sort of a hold up. They come back from a week there to New York City, and it's just amazing what pours out of Dylan that no one even knew was there. You've got a reading, where is this, page 93, about what happened when they got back to New York that produced the album, same name as your book, Another Side of Bob Dylan. It just poured out of him. I wonder if you could read from your father's recollection there, Jacob.
Absolutely. This is actually one of my favorite stories. Here we go. When we got back to New York in August 1964, We dove straight into the recording studio, and Bob played a bunch of new songs, all lyrics he had written while in Vulliugimeni. He played them all one after another without rehearsing. Out of the 11 songs on the album, I had heard maybe one or two on our trip. It was amazing to me. He practiced all by himself, wrote by himself, and never sang them in front of anybody until this moment. And when we got to the studio, he just blurted it out, like electricity building up in a capacitor and then shooting out. He had packed it all inside himself and let it explode. I was on the floor. It knocked the air out of me. I was in a daze. Some of those songs are the best ever. They're not a promise. They're not a dream. It's not BS. He's laying it down so accurately, so clean, he could have been talking about toilet paper and would have still pulled you up. You had to listen to it. This recording session became the album, Another Side of Bob Dylan, and I'll never forget it. While I was swimming in the Aegean Sea, he was making history, and that's how our friendship was. No pressure. You do your thing, and I'll do mine.
And what Dylan did, without a word, without the sound of practice, without the sound of trying lyrics out on your dad, here's just one of the tracks from that album, the immortal Chimes of Freedom, 1964.
Far between sundown's finish and midnight's broken toll, we ducked inside the doorways, thunder went crashing. As majestic bells of bolts struck shadows in the sounds, seeming to be the chimes of freedom flashing.
Tim Riley, this story from Jacob Amuri's book just blew my mind. The idea that all of these songs, and again, I mean, this is All I Really Want to Do, Black Crow Blues, Spanish Harlem Incident, Chimes of Freedom, I Shall Be Free, number 10, To Ramona, right on down, My Back Pages, Ballad in Plain D, It Ain't Me, Babe, all of these internally composed. His dad, Victor, who was with him, never heard them. He steps into his studio when they get home, and in one night, boom, down they go.
And this tells me that Dylan is busy crafting his persona, even for his closest, most intimate, in quotation marks, friends. He is determined that he is going to do this alone. There's no way, I mean, I can't imagine any musician would say that Dylan would step up to the microphone and perform these songs without rehearsing. He must have rehearsed these alone. The fact that he didn't even try them out on his best friend, though, is very telling. It gives you a picture of how private, how closed, how completely autonomous Dylan aims to be with his persona and with the way that he manages his career.
That comes through loud and clear throughout this book. Jacob Amuri's channeling his dad here. Another Side of Bob Dylan, a personal history on the road and off the tracks. Talk about internal. Talk about a man determined to do it his own way. Michael in Atlanta, Georgia. Thanks for calling, Michael. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
How are you?
Okay, what do you know?
Well, I just knew Bob in New York in the Village in 1960.
Oh, just that. How did you know him, Michael?
We were roommates for a while.
Jeez, did you hear him practicing?
What?
Did you hear him rehearsing?
What? Yes, yes. At the time, he was really, really new, and a guy named Fred Neal pretty much took him under his wings and nurtured him along. He owes a lot to several people in the Village, and he was kind of a self-invented show from the beginning until Albert Grossman took care of him.
Became his manager.
Grossman, what?
Became his manager.
Right. Grossman used to refer to him as the amphetamine kid. yeah, he was just another one of the many. I guess I happened to hit the Village at a very good time. There were just a ton of people there who later went on to be pretty well known. Lou Gossett, Richard Pryor.
Bill Cosby, we heard about. Did you think Dylan would be a superstar? Did you have any idea in the early 60s with your roommate would be Bob Dylan?
No, he said he would, though.
A man on a mission. Michael, I appreciate your call. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. There you have it again, Tim. I mean, he was so determined, so early. Behind those curls and that kind of, you know, ramshackle presentation, hot fire.
Well, it's one of the things that this book does really well is recreates that atmosphere, that early atmosphere where there's not really a counterculture yet, but people who are tuned in to the way people's attitudes are changing, they can feel it in the air. And every once in a while, there's a spark that goes off, and there's people chasing these sparks all over the place. And at first, they're a little bit random, and then they start, artists like Dylan start to figure out, hey, I can collect a few sparks here and a few sparks here, and we can start to create a whole new persona, a whole new way of looking things. We can start to address this new audience with our songs. And it's really fun to explore what that atmosphere must have felt like, what it felt like to walk around and stumble upon the young Bob Dylan, whose persona is just getting patched together. That's a really interesting glimpse that this book allows us.
Jacob, did your father have that feeling? We're in a special time. The world's changing. We're going to help change it with this music.
Absolutely. That's one of the things he really focused on in the book, was how fundamentally important that decade was to us now. And it's incredible to me, having written it and really researched that time, how many parallels there are to now, how important Bob's music continues to be. And politically, I mean, we have a lot of the same issues. We still have a lot of racial issues today that parallel issues then, even women's rights with our medical health care laws. 50 years ago, almost to the day, women were fighting for birth control. Some of the states even had it illegal. And we see that issue on a similar note now. And those are the parallels between his music that I find fascinating.
Jacob Mamuda's father was there for all of it. Before he died, he put it down in hours and hours of tape. Jacob Mamuda has brought that to us, put it together in a book, Another Side of Bob Dylan, A Personal History, On the Road and Off the Tracks. We'll move forward. We'll look at his That is Evening with the Beatles when we come back. You can join us. Is Dylan a mystery man to you? Do you want to keep him that way? And what's the question that's always bugged you, dogged you, about Bob Dylan? What do you hear in these tales from Victor Mamudis through his son, Jacob? 800-423-8255. This is On Point.
The curse it is cast. The slow one now will later be fast, as the present now will later be past. The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last. For the times, they are a-changin'. pass the fine. Threw the bums a dime in your prime. Didn't you?
Bob Dylan, the super well-known and the super unknowable there, singing, of course, Like a Rolling Stone. 1970 album Self-Portrait. A guest, Jacob Mamuda's father, was a longtime confidant, tour manager, chess partner, conversation partner with Bob Dylan over nearly 40 years. Before he died, put a lot of his memories down on tape. Jacob has brought them out now in a new book, Another Side of Bob Dylan. You can read an excerpt and see a playlist for this show at our website, onpointradio.org. Jacob Mamudis joins us from Culver City, California. With me in the studio this hour, Tim Riley, music critic, author, rock culture expert, author of Hard Rain, a Dylan commentary, and much more, professor of journalism at Emerson College. You can join us this hour. Is there something beguiling about these old school stories? Before tweets and Instagram, are you glad to hear them? What do you still want to know? We're at 800-423-8255. That takes us to 1970, but I can't skip by the Beatles. You, the famous night, of course, when Bob Dylan meets the Beatles, and your dad describes it. I think I have a little bit of your father. We'll hear you, but there's a little bit of your father's own voice here, where they're getting out of an elevator and going down the hotel room hallway to meet the Beatles. Turns out there'll be a lot of marijuana and partying and Bob Dylan on the floor that night. But here's the voice of Victor Mamudis, telling a little bit of the story.
There's a cop in the elevator. Mm-hmm. We get out of the elevator on the floor. There's a cop in front of every door going down the hallway, sitting in a chair. You know, we go in, there's a room, and there's liquor all over the place, tables of liquor, and the guys, the four guys that greet us. We hang out in the front room of this suite.
Uh-huh.
Where the tables are, and Bob drinks some more liquor, and about an hour he passes out on the floor. Paul is laughing so hard, tears in his eyes. The guys are laughing so hard from the joint.
The Beatles meet Bob Dylan, the voice there of Jacob Mamuda's father, Victor, telling that story. Jacob, I wish you would take it right on with a reading here where he's got Bob grabbing a drink. Bob Dylan, in your father's telling that you write up, tries to roll a joint for the Beatles, sort of blows it, can't get it together. Your father, rather adept at this, steps in. Could you read for us there? It's amazing to hear the Beatles' badinage around this. They didn't have much experience in this realm.
Absolutely, I'll jump right in. So this is off of page 107, and it should be said that this is actually the first time that my father's audio tapes have ever been played publicly.
Wow.
And I'm glad we were able to share his voice here.
Honored to do it.
It was nice to hear that.
Yeah.
Page 107. Bob grabbed a drink while I rolled a joint. When he came back to the coffee table, I lit it with a match and pressed it to him and passed it to him. Bob took a hit and passed it to John, who then handed it to Ringo without putting it to his lips. "You try it," John told Ringo. Ringo hesitated. John called him his royal pot taster. And then Ringo did as John commanded. He held it like a cigarette between his fingers, taking one deep drag after another. He didn't know the proper etiquette of pot, to pass it to John, who was sitting next to him, patiently waiting his turn. I wasn't going to tell him to pass it, because we just met, so I just rolled one for John. He lit up the joint and didn't pass it either. So I rolled another one for Paul, and then again for George. I kept rolling joints till everyone had their own, except Bob. Pretty funny story.
I love that. So what is hipster etiquette here?
Yeah, they have no idea.
Do you tell Ringo, no, you're supposed to pass it? No, you just keep your mouth shut. You just keep rolling those joints there. So there's two elements of this story that are brand new to my understanding of this. And this is a story that is legendary. It gets repeated over and over again about the meeting of these and that Dylan turns on the Beatles. So the first one is that Dylan actually passes out pretty early on. So Dylan is not weeping tears of joy with Paul McCartney. He is passed out on the floor. The other detail is that Victor Mamudis claims that he has a conversation with John Lennon, and Lennon says, oh, no, this isn't the first time we've tried pot.
Right.
This is just the first pot that's actually kicked in. We've actually had pot over in Europe, but it was so weak that we just never did anything for us.
Yeah.
And we know from this story now one reason that it kicked in was that they had a joint apiece.
Yeah, exactly.
The news is on the table. It was amazing that there's this trip across the country where they're stopping in Charlottesville, Virginia. They're stopping in New Orleans. They're going through Colorado. Bob Dylan just in love with New Orleans. On the streets of New Orleans, there's somebody singing his songs, a kind of a busker on the streets who says, who recognizes him or thinks he does, says, "Are you Bob Dylan?" Dylan says, "No, I'm not Dylan," and walks on. But through that, they're listening to the Beatles. This is 1964. They're all over the radio. Dylan in love with Beatles songs, even the very simple, what we think of as simple, "I Want to Hold Your Hand" stuff. Why, Jacob?
Well, I mean, they were confused by the lyrics. The Beatles had that sort of English twang in their voice, and they didn't understand when they were saying, "I want to hold your hand." They were thinking, "I want to get high. I want to get high." And it was confusing for them, but they thought that they were on the same team with that. It was kind of a funny situation.
This was a very important point, because Dylan, as a folky, was part of a camp that just could not take pop music seriously and could not take the Beatles seriously. And then that first year
And yet here he is enthusing about
right.
them.
Well, and so
he did call it. He did call it bubblegum music. I mean, he did refer to it like that
later,
but he still
later,
had an appreciation.
But here he is early on saying, "Listen to the chords there; they're crazy."
So he talks about the harmonies, how sophisticated he thinks the chords are. And Dylan is early on; he is hip to this idea that the Beatles are really onto something very big and not just popular, but actually chasing some really important creative ideas. And this is part of their mutual respect that develops after they meet each other. They're very, very fond of one another's music, and they start influencing each other greatly.
Lindsay in Williamsburg, Virginia. Lindsay, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Love the show. I'm 25, and I love Dylan. I'm also a government major, so a lot of his songs kind of resonate with my intended future plans. I'm just curious, when you listen to his early stuff, there is this major blues and jazz component in it, and it's very African-American, and it's especially at the time. Was Dylan kind of out making this music, trying to make a political statement? Or was that just, you know, a byproduct? Like, would he just like, "Hey, I'm just going to go jam"?
You mean all the African-American music he was picking up on? Let us pick it up, Lindsay. Jacob, what about it? In New Orleans, certainly you've got Dylan down there trying to get into clubs where there's plenty of black artists at work on their music. He doesn't get into all of them. Bouncers turn him away. But what about his affection, love for, embrace of a lot that goes on in African-American music? Political or artistic?
Well, I think it was political. And back then, in the 60s, it was fashionable to create political music. You had artists whose entire repertoire was political, like Phil Oakes. And Dylan tapped into that. He may not have been on the front lines of the picket lines, but he was the adopted voice of those picketers. So, you know, it's one thing for him to be physically sort of political and out there and doing that, but he was political in his music. And I think that he was into that, not only because it was fashionable, because it was something relevant to say. And Bob has always been impartial or always been intrigued by sort of saying what's relevant in his music and tapping into the cultural energy of the time that he's in. He does that even still today.
Making more energy as he goes, moving from the overtly political of some of the folk songs to the more kind of romantic, lyrical, sometimes obscure, often obscure lyrics later on. There's a moment you describe here where this may go to some of the personality questions around Dylan, how he retreated more. Lots of reasons for that, but among them, you write, in 1964, the drinking that put him on the floor of the Beatles hotel room, he just stopped on a dime, your father tells us, Jacob.
Yeah, that's true. And he was around for that, and he sort of talks about how Dylan's persona changed when he gave up alcohol and how he sort of became more introverted because he was compensating for that freedom that alcohol gives you. And it took years for Bob to sort of come out of that and sort of open up again. And it was in the late 90s that Bob started to change and become more and really find his sort of persona again without the need of being sort of intoxicated.
1966, the famous motorcycle accident. After that, Dylan was out of the public eye for a long time, months and months. Victor Mamoudis tells about that accident, says maybe it was not as horrific as we once thought, maybe just needed a break, but from the body of work produced in seclusion is one of the songs he came out of that time with, Million Dollar Bash.
Well, that big dumb blonde with a wheel gorged turtle, that friend of hers with his checks all forged and his cheeks in a chunk with his cheese in the cash. They're all gonna be there at that $1 million bash. Ooh, baby, ooh, baby, ooh.
Million Dollar Bash, Dylan on his basement tapes. Tim Riley, what about that Time Away?
Well, so this is a very important period in Dylan's career because the motorcycle accident, he takes 18 months and recuperating. And, of course, the rumors start to swirl that he's dead, that he'll never work again, that he's washed up, that he's paralyzed. I mean, they didn't really manage the reclusiveness that well. And there's this element of Dylan sort of liking the way that mystery just kind of gloms onto him and builds and grows through all these rumors. What he's really doing is doing daily sessions with the band in upstate New York and producing what we come to know now as the Basement Tapes. Of course, all Dylan fans are eagerly awaiting this new 6-CD box set that's coming out in early November that will present the complete edition, the most complete edition we've had so far of these tapes, the Basement Tapes, that are going to be all cleaned up, and we're very anxious to hear them. And it's another piece of Dylan's autonomy and privacy, the element of his persona, because these are a cornerstone of his greatness, this music. But he was playing all this stuff, performing all this stuff, simply for friends. He had no expectation ever to release any of this music. So if you can imagine, he's doing some of his greatest performances and some of his greatest songs while no one's listening, and it's still great. So that's another piece of the Dylan mystery.
And Jacob Mamuda's father, Victor, along for that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Mark in New Orleans, Louisiana. Mark, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks for having a nice show, Tom. I like the show. I'm going to be quick. Excuse me. As I understand it, Dylan had a motorcycle accident or some kind of trauma in the 60s, and went into like a little period of isolation and ends up in New Orleans living on Magnolia Street. And I think it's when he writes the song Shelter Through the Night. He sings about working on boats or something off of Delacro Island. And what I'm really curious is how much of this myth is actually fact. So I'm just going to listen.
Let us pick it up, Mark. Let us pick it up. Thank you, Mark. Jacob, I don't know. The New Orleans that I've got right in front of me here from your book is on this 1964 cross-country trip. They're driving along. They got a hangover out of Georgia, and then they're into Tuskegee and Montgomery and Selma and Meridian. And then they're into the French Quarter in New Orleans. You describe your father describes a girl coming up to Bob on, I think, Bourbon Street and saying, wow, you sure do have long hair. And Bob Dylan replying, yes, I'm going to let my hair grow down to the street and write my poems from the tops of these buildings. But out on boats and back later and living there? Jacob?
It's hard to say. It wasn't in the tapes. I'm not denying that this did or did not happen, but it just wasn't in the tapes.
Mark, a little mystery is going to have to go on there. I can report to you from the tapes that he tried to get into Baby Green's, and the bouncer said, no way, Bob Dylan could not walk through every door. Daniel in Somerville, Massachusetts. Daniel, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. Daniel Gewirtz, music writer from Somerville.
Yeah, great.
Bob Dylan is the artistic hero of certainly my early life, very important to me, but I've been quite critical of his writing over the last 35 years. I thought he would have a period of God-given genius for 5 years, basically from freewheeling to John Wesley Harding, and then really good for the next 10. And, he has himself occasionally has said something that he's lost his old self. He doesn't know who wrote those early songs or how he did them. He writes songs sometimes by getting phrases out of a box that he's collected. He's lost the impetus. I wondered if he ever talked to Victor about any of his frustrations with writing after, let's say, 1975.
It's a great question. They had their own falling outs and ultimately a falling out before Victor's death. But what about it, Jacob? Did he speak to that?
My father never brought it up on the tapes, but I am aware of Bob saying that on occasion. I think he even said that to Steve Jobs, coming from his biography.
That he lost it, lost something along the way.
Yeah, that he in the 60s, he had this magic, this genius that he really tapped into, and then later on in the 80s and 90s, it just faded. And my father actually talked about that. He talked about how it's like a gas tank that you can kind of run down. But, I still think that, there's some songs that I love that are from Dylan's later work. So I think there's an ebb and flow to that genius that Bob has.
Tim, do you see an explanation in the pages of Jacob's book with his father that might explain some of that arc of creativity?
Well, the lifestyle is really a hard and fast lifestyle. I mean, his manager calls him the amphetamine kid. And, you know, for all of Dylan's religious conversions and all of that stuff, we don't hear a lot of talk about sobriety or, you know, getting off of the drug bandwagon. And so I think that's got to be a factor. And if you've sniffed around the Dylan camp at all, you understand that's still a big factor at play there. I'm curious to ask Jake if he can think of one thing. I mean, this is the kind of book that Dylan probably would not approve of being published. Does Jake have any idea what in this book would piss Dylan off the most?
You know, I'm actually hoping that this book is something that he appreciates. It's written kind of like a love story. Dylan's such an enigma. He's, you know, honestly, he probably wouldn't approve of anyone writing any book about him. So I would say the entire book, but I really do hope that he can find something that he likes about this. I really do hope that it helps their relationship, my father's and Bob's relationship.
There is an amazing passage late in the book, Dylan on the road, on the road, on the road, and sometimes it's hard to raise the emotion needed to deliver the song, and your father reminds him, you know, hey, Bob, there's some kids out in that audience who piled into a car and drove 5 hours to see you tonight, and they're waiting to hear you, and Bob Dylan rising to that. It does seem like a love story at that moment, Jacob, and we appreciate your capturing it and putting it down. The book is Another Side of Bob Dylan, A Personal History, on the road and off the tracks. We could talk for hours, but we're out of our hour. Jacob Amudis, thanks so much for bringing it to us.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
And Tim Riley, always great to have you right here. Thanks for coming in.
Great to be here, Tom.
Go out with My Back Pages, 1964, from the album of the same name, Another Side of Bob Dylan. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.
Quite clear, no doubt, somehow. Ah, but I was so much older then. I'm younger than that now.